Accession number 17975, Egon Brent, reel 2.
Egon Brent, reel 2. Yes, I was asking, you know, if you can remember your experience of Kristallnacht, Mr. Brent.
My personal experience with hindsight, I remember the first really what is called the Kristallnacht, throwing bricks into windows. And very near me, I went in my district, it was a residential district, quite a good residential district, but there were a few shops, and these shopping centers, people went from house to house, threw the two bricks in the window. There was, of course, some looting, people followed and so on. That came suddenly. I had no idea what that was. I mean, now we know it's a Kristallnacht, now we know it didn't happen locally. At that time I thought, oh, that was just locally. It was the criminals, they were hooligans. I just didn't connect it in the first moment with the Nazi movement. But soon after that, of course. And that was the first night I did not go home. I slept not there where I later did, but I slept with some other friend who was not Jewish, because I realized something is going on. I mean, a day or two later we knew what happened in that night, that the synagogues were desecrated and houses put on fire and businesses destroyed. That's all that documented. That was my experience of the Kristallnacht, which came quite suddenly. As I said, first I thought it was just local hooliganism, but it transpired very, very, very soon what it really was. And from that onwards, of course, all the possibilities we explored where to go. We were all desperate. There was a possibility to, some people went to Brazil, some people went to here and there, but the difficulty was to get a visa. For instance, I mentioned again my mother-in-law, who was at that time in America, and she tried to get me and her daughter over to America on an American visa, but there was a list, a quota, our numbers, they were not up for a long time. We had an affidavit, that was called an affidavit, which was sent to us from America, that somebody would look after us there. But we could not make use to us, neither Irene nor I could make use of that affidavit, because of the quota, and we were at that time quite at the bottom. So that was out. Jews were taken, we had no passports anymore. The passports were taken away. Now my reasoning was, if suddenly I would have the chance to go abroad here and there, because you could go without a visa to, for instance, Peru, you could go to Shanghai. So what I did, I applied for a passport, I bought a ticket for Peru to prove that I have the intention to go there. When my passport came, and they knew I was not going, because I had no intention to go, I didn't know how to make a living there, and so on. They took my passport again, but it was there. There was an advantage. It was kept by the Gestapo, and at that time I was told these people were actually quite businesslike. When I need it, I can get it. That was an advantage. At least I knew I could go and get my passport. And so I did write numerous letters to Brazil, I remember, to France, which all was very, very difficult. Of course, England was my first choice. England is in an island. The channel was in between, it was a sort of safety in England. I personally, actually, all the time, I was very much interested in the British Empire. I did read a lot about the Reich, the Indian Reich, and the Commonwealth, and so on. So for me, Britain was on top, but Britain was the most difficult country to get into. As I said, I could have gone with my business, but that was not possible later anyhow. And after that collapsed, I didn't do anything there. Anyhow, all our life just consisted of finding possibilities to go abroad, to find somewhere. How are you? Shall I tell you now how I came to? That was also through the circle of Irene. Her sister, she has a sister who had sort of a friend who emigrated to England and who apparently had some connections here and knew. At that time I didn't know what a trainee visa is, who I corresponded with, and I asked him and I implored him, is there any possibility that you can do anything? I knew he had some connections here and so on, and he was he did quite a lot for me and came up finally with a letter. He tried to get me to Brazil or to things like that, and finally there came a letter. Or do you want to go to England? And so by return, I did write, are you in your right mind to ask me that? That is my first choice. Of course. So I didn't, then I said, it's out. If somebody says he can get me to England, there's something fishy. There were so many things, agents, fishy things, who took money and so. And nothing came of it. So I said, oh, that's out. But the result was, within 2 weeks' time, I became from the Home Office a pink card. I didn't know at that time what a trainee visa was, but it was a visa. I should go to the embassy with my passport and get my visa to England and so on. So I didn't believe it. And I phoned around all my friends, have you ever experienced such a pink card and so on? And then one of my friends said, who had a similar thing, she went as a domestic, yes, that's it. So I went to the Gestapo and it was not quite easy. They, at that time, they tried to whatever they could to try. They tried to annoy people, make it difficult, or so. But somehow, in the office there was some girl, some receptionist, and she heard me and she made some. Gave me some sign I should go out and should go away and come back in 2 hours' time. So I came back after 2 hours and she said, I managed to get your passport here. And the next day I went to the consulate, the British consulate had my visa, and then the immigration started. I took my ticket, but nothing was that easy. We were not allowed to take so many things with us. Of course, as we were allowed to take 10 shillings, you know how little that was. And of course, clothing and so on. So my mother decided whatever we could get to England, our household crockery, linen and so on, I would take with me. And so a professional firm came with boxes and they loaded whatever they could be loaded, books and whatever there was. But that had to be cleared before it went to the, before it was sent away. And these people, they're very nasty people. Mine was terribly nasty. For instance, I had perhaps 150 books. I had quite a library. So whatever was political, he threw out. I knew that before. I did sort them out before. But books which were hardly political or so, he was quite ignorant. So he said, better out. So out of these 150 books, there were about 30 left. Okay. Now, nothing mattered. At that time, we were so far, nothing mattered. Sorts of other things, documents or so, were thrown out. But that didn't matter. I was happy after a few hours that he put a stamp on my list and cleared it, and these things were taken away by a firm to be transported here. I remember here I could mention that how nasty and so they were. For instance, as I said, my mother sent all her crockery and everything, wine glasses, crystal, and whatever there was, because at that time I still had hope to get my mother over as well. And in Hamburg, these boxes, or most of the boxes, were opened to make spot checks. And all two boxes were with, as I said, with valuable crockery, with partly Meissen porcelain and Rosenthal porcelain and so on. They took from each box a big item out, for instance, a soup tureen, and all the things which were nicely professionally packed, of course, were loose inside. So when that particular box arrived here, all what was left are about six crystal glasses, which we still have here, a minimum of odd things and so on. That was just nastiness. Because they would know what happened. But nothing mattered at that time. And then came the great day when I could go to the station. I was brought with my family. My family did see me off. I mean, the older generation, which carried anyhow. My mother did see me off, and a friend of mine, and so on. And then I went on the train to Hoek van Holland. The nearer I came to the border, the more nervous I got, because we knew all these, which is documented as well. I'm pretty sure you know all that. There were difficulties at the border. Some people had to undress completely and search everything. The only thing I had saved, I had a little sentimental souvenir, a little clover in silver. I had it round my neck and so on, which I was not allowed to take, because it was so before the border. I was so nervous, I took that and did threw it in the toilet, just to have no. Anyhow, they searched me in a certain way. It was not too difficult, but anyhow, border, and it was the first happy moment, as you can imagine. You were under a strain all these months and so on, and then I was suddenly on the ferry to Harwich from Hoek van Holland with 10 shillings and so on. Do you remember?
Yes. I suppose when you said goodbye to your mother at the station, you've explained you expected you were trying to get her to England. Was that a sad parting, though? Did you have any?
It was a very sad parting, because in the back of our minds we knew how difficult it was. And the example was, we did see it, I did see it, my friends, my family, none of the older people at that time had any chance of leaving. Yes, it was a very sad parting. So there was a heritage at one time. And
what was your first impression of Britain, you know, when you were sort of taking your journey from Harwich? I wonder what you thought of the place. people when you first arrived?
I arrived in the dark in the evening, and that particular gentleman I talked about who sent me the trainee visa, he didn't at that time himself what a trainee visa was, but he found a job. He worked in the clothing trade, and one of the outdoor tailors gave me a job. As the thing was still a little bit vague or so, he thought it's a good thing. He knew he would pay me about £1.10 per week, and he would have some cheap labor. And he apparently thought it was a tailoring business. I would do some tailoring there. I have no idea about tailoring or so. That is the thing. So it was all the gray area, but it soon transpired. The next day I went to Bloomsbury House, where the committee was, the Jewish committee, and there I was explained what it was. I mean, I was quite happy, and I went to the firm I worked for, and they put me right away on a job, on a machine job or so, and so I said, I can do certain things, but you don't think I'm a machine or what you expect me to do. So the boss was terribly disappointed, and there was some moment, some serious moment, but he was a nice person, and very soon he realized he did do a good job. So he kept me, and he paid me 30 shillings, and I did do work I could do. He trained me for putting lining into coats. I could do that. I'm technical mining, I could use a needle and so on. And it wasn't a job for me. I can imagine me sitting there from morning to evening, putting lining in a coat and sewing. Anyhow, I was here, I was happy. Nothing could disturb that. I had many, I met people here, some friends, but they were all in the same position. They all had no money. When Irene came over, my wife, who was later my wife, was just the same. We were all in the same boat, so life went on very, very happily for that time.
Were you given any help by Bloomsbury House?
I didn't need any help. I never was. People who were in need were given help, they were given money. The only time I was subsidized for 1 week was after the war broke out. Because after the war broke out, that firm I was working for closed down. And so I had to go to Bloomsbury House, and they gave me some money for a week. But a week later I got a note that I could start away. These people were very good to me, actually, who were first disappointed and so on. I did, after all, I earned my money and so on. That was when the war broke out.
What were you thinking of England, though? You know, you had come to this country, you've explained you spoke the language, but I wonder what you thought of England. I wonder what you made of England, and, you know, how it compared with the sort of culture of Germany.
Starting with the first days, I was too busy to do anything. I had a very mingy room in Maple Street, which is a little, was a slummy street off Tottenham Court Road. It doesn't exist anymore, it's all rebuilt, it's now, it was all bombed and so on. And the gentleman who got me over, he supplied a furnished room for me, because I did write to him. As you know, I'm working in Charlotte Street. I know fares are quite expensive in England, so can you get me lodgings very near where I work that I can walk? And he found that for me, but he realized it was very slummy and so on. And the nearer we came, we were walking, he picked me up in Liverpool Street. We went to Tottenham Court Road by underground, and we walked there. And the nearer we came, we became more and more nervous. And he said, I don't know whether it's the right thing, you can't expect much, and so on and so on. And when we knocked the door, there came a very dirty woman down there. talked in Cockney, and I couldn't understand one word, and he understood a bit and so on. And I had that room on the floor. Nothing could disturb me. I was happy. It was a happy day, or whatever it was. So I realized I was tired. There was not much light anyhow. So I slipped into bed. I didn't want to look inside. There was a brown blanket on top, but I don't know how clean it was or not. Anyhow, I just wanted to sleep. I slept in. At that age, you take things different anyhow. So the next morning I took stock, and there was a wardrobe which did fall over me because it had only 2 feet. There was a chest of drawers. Two had only a front, and one had a front and the bottom. And so all my little things, I had only hand luggage, I put in there. Then I found there, of course, the famous gas ring you have in a bedsit, and the famous tea kettle, which I didn't know before, the cheapest tin kettle, which was not quite clean anyhow. So I hardly did know how to use it. I had still some sandwiches, so I had some breakfast also. Later I bought some eggs on the way, and I boiled these eggs in the tea kettle. I managed to get some in the thing there. And then that was my first day. I had not much time because there were formalities. I had to go to the Jungfrauhaus, then I had to register with the police in Bow Street. That took the whole day, and I was requested to work the next day, which was fine with me. I worked till about 6 o'clock, and there was hardly any time to look at London. My London consisted, I went out later, consisted for several days going along Tottenham Court Road, Oxford Street to Marble Arch, and the other side, New Oxford Street to the Holborn District. That I was walking that nearly every day, and that was my London. The first Saturday, I was decided to get out of that room as quick as possible. The next Saturday, I made my first excursions. I walked along Tottenham Court Road up north, and then I came to Camden Town, which at that time was more slummy than it is now. These districts now, is Lincoln also a quite posh district now, at that time it was not. Anyhow, I went to Camden Town, Kentish Town, and then I came to Chalk Farm, and there I did see the first trees. And that was Haverstock Hill. And then I said, oh, that's London. London can be nice. There are trees. I walked up at that time very quickly, so you could do a lot in one day. I walked up Haverstock Hill, I looked right, left, there were some night shops. There was occasionally a restaurant. And then I came to England Lane. If you know the district, you probably know there. And then there was a street on the right which appealed to me very much. It was at that time called Stanley Gardens. It was in the middle, there was a green for the residents, and they were all terraced houses round in a half circle. That's then the gardens, red buildings and so on, one next to the other, which looked very posh and so on. So I went along there, and then I found a sign, attic to let. So I said, that's not for me, because it will be quite expensive. And somebody opened the door, and I said, excuse me, before we go, how much is that? And he said, 10 shillings a week. That's what I paid there. And very pleasant young man took me up, and he said, you're very lucky, this attic which we lit for 10 shillings has been newly decorated, you have new furniture, you have a new bed, and it looks big spin. And so there was, of course, no hesitation. I said, my God, I take it right away, I paid some deposit. And it was a happy time in that house, because that gentleman happened to be here. He spoke German as well. He was a son of rich family. His mother was a writer, and she lived in a country house, and she owned that property, and he was there. He had studied in Germany philosophy. He had a degree from Hamburg University. And so we became very, very soon friends. He knew more or less our background. And he was actually the one who was better, who later he was as well when war broke out. He was quite a high-ranking officer in the intelligence corps. And he was actually the one who gave me a reference. And
Yes, I haven't asked you the date when you came over.
I came over on the 13th of April, 1939.
This was very near, of course, to the outbreak of war.
Yes.
Yes. When did Irene come over?
It went very quick. I could found through a job, but she came over in June.
And you're saying she came over to do domestic work?
Domestic work, yeah.
Yes. That you know, would that have been very different, a very different sort of life for Irene?
Yes, of course. Yes and no. Even she's much younger than I. She's 11 years younger than I was, so she was very young. And she started a commercial job in Germany, but she had to leave after a week because she was Jewish and she was, anyway. And she had some training, some house in some organization. She worked voluntarily in some organization and did do housework there. So she carried on here. That was no problem because the all our friends also, it was the only way to get a visa. Married couples, they got jobs as butler and maid or so.
And when were you married, Mr.
We were married in June 1940. When I was called up in December to the army, so we wanted to get married before, but there were difficulties with the documentation because part of my documentation was with the war office, and I couldn't get it back that quickly. And before I could get it back, we were sent with the BF to France in March 1940. Right. So that fell through. There was a lot of bureaucracy. It could have been done, but it wasn't. But we married on after I came back from France in June 1940. After a week, we got our first leave, 3 days leave, disembarkation leave, it was called. And I took the telephone, I'm coming in 2 days to London. Can we get married on that day? And so she went to Hampstead Register Office, and there were no problems. There are similar cases like mine. People knew I was here only. So everything went very smoothly. No bureaucracy. We got our license, a special license, of course. And so we married on the 27th of June. And I went back the next morning to my army camp.